What should your blood pressure be? The answer to that question is controversial. Recently, with great fanfare, the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association promoted lower targets for what's considered normal blood pressure. They also advised more aggressive treatment of blood pressure down to lower levels than most physicians are comfortable with. The new guidelines were widely criticized because they would then result in classifying millions of patients as having hypertension who now don't carry that diagnosis. It would also require the treatment of millions of patients who currently are not receiving it. The combined American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association is big, but the guideline represents the view from the U.S., and not everyone in the U.S. agrees with it. The Europeans have been developing their own guideline, which when recently released appeared to be very different, perhaps more reasonable. In today's JAMA Clinical Reviews podcast, we cover the battle of the heart societies and how they differ in terms of defining hypertension and how aggressively it should be treated.
From the JAMA Network, this is JAMA Clinical Reviews, interviews and ideas about innovations in medicine, science, and clinical practice. Here's your host, Ed Livingston.
To help us understand these guidelines, we reached out to the authors of both the U.S. and the European guidelines. Dr. Greg Kerfman, a JAMA deputy editor, and I had a discussion with these authors regarding the similarities and differences between the U.S. and the European hypertension guidelines. Who did we talk to?
Paul K. Welton. I am the Chotwan Professor of Global Public Health at Tulane University in New Orleans, and on this call because I chaired the writing committee for the 2017 American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association Blood Pressure Guidelines.
Okay, and Dr. Williams?
Yeah, I'm Brian Williams. I'm Chair of Medicine at University College London, and I'm on this call because I was the ESC, European Society of Cardiology, Chair of the joint guidelines between the ESC and the European Society of Hypertension.
Dr. Kerfman?
And I'm Greg Kerfman, Deputy Editor at JAMA and a cardiologist by training.
And I'm Ed Livingston, an outlier because I'm a surgeon, but I'm the Deputy Editor for Clinical Reviews and Education at JAMA, and I produce the Clinical Reviews podcasts. Thank you for joining us. What we wanted to do was to discuss these two guidelines from the U.S. side and the European side regarding hypertension. And there's been a lot of discussion about the differences between them, most especially regarding what is defined as having blood pressure and what the targets are for treatment. But Drs. Williams and Welton have written a viewpoint in JAMA, and they point out the very many similarities between the guidelines, which receive a lot less discussion. So I wonder if we could start this discussion with a review of what's similar about the guidelines. Where are they the same?
There are indeed many similarities. So we both focus on the importance of accuracy in blood pressure measurements. We both focus on confirming high blood pressure. In the U.S. guidelines, we say you can use out-of-office approaches, and in the European guidelines, you can do that in the office or out of office. We both underscore the importance of not only measuring blood pressure, but understanding an individual's cardiovascular risk in order to make treatment decisions. We utilize a similar array of non-farm lifestyle interventions, a similar array of antihypertensive drug treatments. We both recommend combination drug therapy, preferably for us, a single pill combination. The European guideline stresses that even more than we do. We recommend combinations of the same classes of drugs. We both underscore the importance of blood pressure control at the center of all of this. We both employ targets during treatment that are lower than were previously recommended in major U.S. guidelines and major European guidelines. We both emphasize functionality rather than chronologic age in managing high blood pressure in older adults. And we both underscore the great importance of appropriate treatment to actually control and recommend strategies to improve control of high blood pressure. And finally, we both recommend areas that are still uncertain and need additional research. So an awful lot that's in common.
One of the interesting aspects of this new guideline is the emphasis on home blood pressure monitoring or ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and how people should go about doing it?
So I think what's become apparent over the past few years are a couple of things. Firstly, that many patients diagnosed with hypertension in the clinic could potentially have a normal blood pressure in the out-of-office situation. And that's because their blood pressure may become elevated during measurement in the clinic. And we think that's about up to 25% of patients with so-called white coat or isolated office hypertension. So one of the advantages of doing out-of-office measurements is that it will enable patients, first of all, to appreciate if their blood pressure is elevated when they measure it themselves, and that improves their engagement, but probably also improves the likelihood that you will detect patients whose blood pressure is not quite as elevated as it might have seemed in the office. The other group of patients are those who have so-called masked hypertension. So they are normotensive when they get their blood pressures measured in the office, but when they measure their blood pressures at home, either with themselves or with ambulatory, their blood pressure is elevated. Now, again, it's up to 15-20% of patients can have this condition, and they tend to be those with high normal blood pressures or stage 1 hypertension, which is the same category in the United States. And we've recommended, as of the American guidelines, that these patients should have their blood pressures measured more formally out of the office, so to try and detect whether they have confirmed hypertension. I think the other point about particularly home measurement that studies have demonstrated is that it does improve patient engagement with their treatment. And there are even studies where patients have self-monitored and self-medicated and adjusted their treatment on the basis of home blood pressures and achieved better blood pressure control than conventional care. So I think once we began to look at all of that data, we realized that we had to make a recommendation that this was at least as good as repeated office blood pressure measurements and probably superior. And I think the Americans, in fact, actually recommended this as the primary way of confirming the diagnosis, with the Europeans still allowing the repeated office measurement as an option and not going completely over to home or ambulatory, but certainly recommending it.
Yeah, I have to relate an anecdote because my wife is a primary care physician, and I once asked her why compliance with hypertension management is so poor. And she said, when you talk to patients, they don't perceive themselves as being sick. It's just a number you tell them, and they don't relate to it. They don't feel it. They don't have pain. They don't have discomfort. So because they don't feel that they're sick, they tend not to take the medications. So this issue of engagement and having them monitor their own blood pressure to understand that they really do have a disease, I think is a very important point that you just raised.
I often use that strategy in my clinic, and I find it particularly with some younger patients will say to me, "But I'm sure, doctor, it's only because I had trouble parking the car and I rushed into the surgery today because I was a bit late." And I say, "Okay, well, why don't you take this monitor home with you and measure your own blood pressure when you're at home in your home environment, and let's see what the readings look like." And it's amazing when they come back and you look at them together and you agree that actually they're elevated and they're much more accepting of the diagnosis.
Masked hypertension is particularly insidious because almost all of the studies suggest that individuals with that type of hypertension have a cardiovascular risk that's very similar to sustained hypertension where you're high in the office and outside. White coat's a little uncertain. In both cases, we really don't have trials that have specifically looked at them, so it's down to expert opinion for advice on how to manage patients with white coat and masked hypertension. But as Brian said, we are now recognizing that both are quite common and represent a challenge for clinicians in practice and for the patients themselves.
You raise a really interesting point that I've pondered as I've looked at these papers, which is the recommendations come from a few trials, and we'll get to SPRINT in a little bit, which weighs heavily on these recommendations. But those trials, as I understand them, pretty much rely on in-office blood pressure measurements. So how an outpatient measure translates to outcomes, one really needs to wonder. Is there much concern about that we may be measuring something very different than what informs us from the clinical trials?
I think there's some concern that have been expressed about how you translate that information across. We have very good data to get comparable levels. If you look at epidemiological studies that have been done where patients have measured home blood pressure or ambulatory and then asked the question, what level of clinic blood pressure gives the same level of risk as a particular home or ambulatory blood pressure average, then we've got that data. And it's quite remarkable, having analyzed that data in Europe and looked at the analysis in the US, the tables are all actually identical in terms of the equivalence. So 140 over 90 is equivalent to a daytime average of 135.85 and a 24-hour average of 130 over 80. So the values are different, but they do correspond to the same level of risk. But you're absolutely right. We've never actually used those measurements to stratify people for treatment in a clinical trial. I would argue that actually, if anything, because clinic blood pressure in the past has probably, in the trials, have included some patients who've had white coat hypertension, maybe many as 20% perhaps, maybe we've even underestimated the benefits of treatment in those trials, assuming those patients who were not as hypertensive as we thought were actually perhaps not getting as much absolute benefit as we thought. So maybe if we'd done the trials purely based on out-of-office blood pressure, we might have seen an even greater effect, but that's pure speculation.
And, of course, we'd always like to have everything line up 100%, but that rarely happens in clinical practice. So we're at that stage now. We've moved from diastolic to systolic. We're still with office blood pressure measurements. I imagine as we go forward, at some stage there will be a shift to looking at cardiovascular outcomes in using out-of-office blood pressure measurements. As Brian has indicated, he has been a leader for some very exquisite studies that show that using out-of-blood pressure measurements for management will result likely in much better control. So we're gradually moving in that area, but there is uncertainty.
I mean, it is remarkable. We haven't changed the way we measure blood pressure for more than about 100 years. People still pitching up to the doctor's office, sitting down and having their blood pressure measured, whereas pretty much everything else is embracing the concept of remote monitoring and doing things in a different way in medicine. And I'm sure with the sort of digital revolution, et cetera, that's going on and the advances in technology, this will gain hold pretty quickly. And I think patients are going to start pitching up in the surgery, well, they already do, in fact, with copies of their blood pressure records on their phones and, you know, using very regular measurements with all kinds of additional detail, and that's going to become part of routine care.
And when you think about high blood pressure, measurement is one of the two or three huge issues that we have to try to confront, because we know how to measure properly. We've known that for years and years and years. We do it reasonably well in research studies, whether they're observational studies or they're clinical trials. But in clinical practice, no matter what country you go to, because we're under time pressures, we really don't take it seriously in exams or in accreditation, it's done very poorly, and so people are mislabeled, misdiagnosed, mistreated. There's no question about that. So that's one of the issues, and hopefully over time, the measurement issues will become a little easier. We'll have better approaches that will allow us to better classify and better manage patients with high blood pressure.
Yeah, those are really, really good points. You discuss differences in the ambulatory blood pressure monitoring or home blood pressure monitoring. One type of home blood pressure monitoring is the use of a commercially available device called home blood pressure monitoring. The other is ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, which requires wearing a device much like a Holter monitor. Could you explain to us the difference between the two and why you would select one approach over the other?
So ambulatory monitoring does give you a lot more information, particularly around nighttime blood pressure, which of course you don't usually get from home blood pressure monitoring, although some devices are being developed with timers that would allow the machine to make a measurement using a conventional home monitor at night. So the idea of ambulatory measurement is you do a series of readings just over a 24-hour period. you have so many readings, you average those readings, you get a value, and that gives you a reasonably accurate perception of your blood pressure status. With home monitoring, you have to do readings on multiple days, usually seated as you would in the doctor's office, a couple of readings in the morning, a couple of readings in the afternoon. Most guidelines recommend a minimum of 3 days and ideally 4 to 7 days to get a decent average of your blood pressure. So they are slightly different in terms of one fitting, the other one more ambulant, and also including sleep measurements. And so they can give a different perspective on your blood pressure. Having said that, the remarkable thing is that, you know, mean daytime average on ambulatory monitoring looks to correspond to a home average blood pressure for most patients. If you look at the data for equivalent values, so 135/85 is equivalent to 140/90, both on daytime ABPM and on home average. It's the nighttime pressures which are much lower. The upper limit of normal for 140/90 is 120/70 as a nighttime average. And sometimes it's the nighttime pressure which is particularly elevated, particularly in people with sleep apnea, people with secondary hypertension, diabetes, with autonomic dysfunction, etc. So there are specific indications where you might want to use ambulatory monitoring to get a better profile of the overall 24-hour period.
I would say out-of-office measurements, when you're doing home blood pressure measurements, very similar to what we do in the office. In this case, we have to train the patient to take their own blood pressure. So you need the same sort of training that you would need in an office setting to get an accurate blood pressure measurement. We do encourage multiple readings. I think most clinicians are particularly interested in the morning readings before somebody takes their medication, because that will give you some indication of nighttime blood pressure. The ambulatory does not require as much in the way of training on the part of the patient, because we fit the patient with the cuff and it's an automatic device. In the U.S., in contrast to Europe, we don't use ambulatory blood pressure monitoring outside of the research arena very much. It's not widely available. The reimbursement for ambulatory blood pressure monitoring is not sufficient to get most clinicians interested. So we believe in general that from the studies that ambulatory blood pressure monitoring will give you somewhat better estimates of cardiovascular risk based on blood pressure measurement. But on a practical basis, home measurements are more viable, at least in the U.S. I think, Brian, a little different for you in Europe.
No, I think home measurements are certainly more viable, and actually in many cases more preferable from the patient's perspective, because not all patients like wearing ambulatory monitors. They can be uncomfortable, particularly when they inflate on a repeated basis in patients who've got very high blood pressures.
Yes, especially at nighttime. And as you pointed out, the lower you go in the pressures, the more you get down to where we have a cut point for high blood pressure, the more similar pressures measured in the office and out of the office become. So it is remarkable that they correspond so well, really.
Dr. Kerfman, you've been quiet. Do you have any more thoughts about the similarities between the guidelines or any of the other issues that we thought or anything that we might have missed that we should cover?
Yes, Ed, thank you. I would like to ask a question about blood pressure in older adults, say 65 years of age and older. I know that the U.S. and European guidelines do have some differences in recommendations for management of older adults. And in fact, the American College of Physicians, who also has a set of guidelines, has a cutoff of 150 systolic for healthy 60-year-olds and older. So there seems to be some difference in viewpoints on how to manage blood pressure in older adults, and this is a particularly challenging group of patients. So I wonder if either one or both of you might have some comments about older adults.
I'll take a stab at it, and Brian can add in. I think in general, both guidelines have some similarities. We obviously have differences, but in this area, we both underscore the importance of functionality rather than chronologic age. If somebody is healthy, then you're more comfortable with starting lower or getting to lower pressures. The second thing we recognize is that individuals who are older are at high risk for many outcomes, and particularly important ones to them are cardiovascular. And I think we would all agree, if we ask our patients what concerns them and they're older, they'll mention a couple of things fairly quickly. Stroke always seems to come up quite early because they've seen people debilitated from stroke. If they've had friends who've had heart failure, that will come up. They're worried about dementia. Those are three very common concerns for an older person. And these are outcomes that with pretty good information, particularly for stroke and for heart failure, can be improved by lowering blood pressure. Now, where to start, how low to go, you know, there's a little difference. The ACP, AAFP guideline, which may be correct, is an outlier compared to what's recommended by the two guidelines we're talking about today, as well as most of the newer national guidelines, the Canadian guidelines, the Australian guidelines. We're all recommending starting lower than, in general, than what is recommended in that guideline, and going to lower levels of blood pressure. So we're looking at the same data. It's a matter of interpreting the data. Probably we can't be sure who is right, but certainly most of the guidelines are suggesting functionality, starting lower and getting to lower pressures. And Brian, our two guidelines are a little different, but they have much in common in how to manage older adults with high blood pressure.
I think this being one of the most important changes that's taken place in both of the guidelines. If you look at the JNCH or whatever it was when it came out in 2013, defining people as older above the age of 60, having a threshold for intervention above 150 and a target below 150, that was a really big change in a more conservative direction. Both guidelines now recommend treatment at least at 140. I mean, Europe has moved the threshold for intervention for all older patients down to 140, except the very elderly. I'll come back to that in a second. So people above the age of 65, treat at 140 systolic and get the blood pressure below 140 and ideally down to 130. And that's something that's not often picked up. I've heard people say to me that the target is in Europe is less than 140. It isn't. In the elderly, it's less than 140 and getting down to 130. So in other words, we've given a sort of spread and a range to get to if it's tolerated. And that's a key message in the elderly. You go as low as you can get it, but you need to monitor for tolerability, particularly renal function, particularly patient well-being, because it will vary on a patient-by-patient basis. And I think as you get older, your treatment needs to be more focused on individualization, as the tolerability will vary according to the biological age of the individual. So we've both, I think, recommended much more aggressive targets for elderly patients, and I think it reflects the recognition that a lot of the misnomers that these patients wouldn't be able to tolerate treatment, these patients might get falls, these patients would get huge amounts of dizzy spells, this hasn't been borne out in the trials, and I think the SPRINT trial was particularly important in this context because it took blood pressure lower than we've seen before in this population. And it confirmed that none of those things were necessarily true. So it certainly gave us confidence in Europe to be more aggressive about our blood pressure targets in the elderly. And, you know, the thing that frustrates me is we get a lot of people debating about whether it should be down to 130 or lower than 130. I say if we can get most elderly people down to 130, that's good. I mean, that's a long way from where we are at the moment. And I think that's what we should be focusing on, getting down to those sort of numbers.
And I think, as Brian said, you know, the focus now on functionality is very, very important. We have good evidence that you can reduce the risk of stroke, heart failure. There's emerging evidence from the trials that you might be able to have a beneficial effect on cognitive function and perhaps on dementia. So outcomes that are really important to older people. Now, clearly in both guidelines and certainly in ours, we've said if somebody is institutionalized or has a lot of comorbidity and poor outlook, then, you know, the decision ought to be a team decision with a lot of patient input as to whether to treat and how intensively to treat. And always when you're treating, and this most especially when you're treating an older adult, you have to be careful and you have to monitor and you have to adjust the treatment as is appropriate. So it's not a number we're treating patients. And I think both guidelines underscore that, that these are guidelines, they're there to try to help clinicians and adults get better health. But they're no more than that, and they're not prescriptive. Thou must get below a particular number.
Both guidelines have converged very closely, in fact, identically, on the recommended treatment strategies for hypertension. You know, we now have a situation where we're recommending the majority of patients are treated with combination therapy, usually of a RAS blocker with a CCB or a diuretic or a combination of all three of those drugs. I think that's a very important development. Both guidelines recommend beta blockers when there are guideline indications for them, for example, in heart failure, angina, et cetera. And both guidelines have emphasized that adherence to therapy is a much bigger problem than we recognized, and it seems to be directly related to the number of pills. And that's why both guidelines have recommended using combinations of drugs and ideally a single pill combinations when possible, to try and reduce pill burden and improve compliance. In Europe, that's a central tenet of our recommendation, basically the concept of a single pill strategy to treat blood pressure, recognizing that monotherapy is inadequate therapy for most people and that we need to be getting quickly onto two drugs and ideally starting with two drugs in most patients if we're going to get to these targets, and where possible use single pill combinations to reduce pill burden. And I think that's a very, very important development in the guidelines, and I think it's something that patients will appreciate. The idea that they can go to their doctor and independent of the severity of the hypertension, in most cases, will be able to be controlled with a single pill, which may or may not contain two or three drugs. I don't know what you think, Paul, but we generally felt that was quite an important point of emphasis in terms of trying to improve control.
We also felt that control, even though it's better in the U.S. than in many countries, it's still inadequate in the U.S., and it's terrible when we look broadly or across the world. So we focused a lot on trying to improve control rates, if you will, adherence to therapy, so diagnosing properly, getting the appropriate treatment, but then adherence, very, very important, just as Brian mentioned, using a team, because we know clinicians are overburdened with many responsibilities, many new guidelines that are asking for more. So, and we know that other members of the team can be very effective, especially if it's possible to have a pharmacist or a nurse involved. But if not, staff members in the office can be trained. Spouses and friends and others in the community, like healthcare workers, can be trained. Focusing and helping people to improve their lifestyle, taking advantage of the electronic medical record actively to track who's taking their meds, who's showing up, who needs special attention. If necessary, it's possible, telemonitoring so you get feedback from outside the office. There are a number of these strategies that are well proven to help patients to have better control rates, and that's a very important aspect of both guidelines.
Yeah, the job's not done when you write the script is the message, I think. And one of the interesting things we found when we were looking into this was that the most common patients who are uncontrolled, and not that they're untreated, although they are untreated in many parts of the world, but even when they're treated, most of them remain on a single pill. And that single pill is usually one drug. So that's been a problem, therapeutic inertia. So one way of overcoming therapeutic inertia is to start a single pill that at least has two drugs in it. That greatly increases the chance that the patient's blood pressure is going to be controlled. And we have evidence now that starting treatment on two drugs doesn't cause problems of hypotension and increased adverse effects in the same way as treating the elderly didn't cause those problems either.
And we especially underscored exactly what Brian is suggesting in two settings. One, the individual who is diagnosed with a pressure that is higher, and we gave some specific cut points, but clearly that's the type of person who will not do well in a single agent. They need to start with two, they may even need three. And the other was African-American adults with high blood pressure. We know that they are almost never controlled with a single agent. They require two, and they require a diuretic or a dihydropyridine CCB as part of that combination regimen. So those two areas in particular, we made a formal recommendation. For all others, we encouraged the use of combination therapy, and single pill combinations were appropriate, and we provided in our guideline all the listing of available combination agents in the U.S.
That wraps up this first episode of a two-part JAMA Clinical Reviews podcast on the new hypertension guidelines. In part one, we emphasize the similarities between the guidelines, and in part two, we'll discuss the differences. But we can always continue the conversation online. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please review and rate our podcast. It really helps us know how we're doing and makes it easier for people to find our content. This episode also has CME, and you've already done most of the work towards earning credit for this activity. There's still an article to read and a brief quiz. Please go back to the article and read it, and then take the CME quiz. Links to the article and the quiz are available in the description for this episode. Do you want to get all of our Clinical Reviews podcasts and CME in the same place? Check out JN Listen in the Apple Store. It's our new app that has all of our Clinical Reviews podcasts and the ability to get CME from them in the app. There's no need to go back to the article to get CME. You can also find the entire array of the JAMA Network podcasts at jamanetworkaudio.com. There's a wealth of information about these new guidelines and hypertension management in general in the JAMA Network. We have a website, sites.jamanetwork.com/JNC8, that has a large collection of articles about hypertension management and information about the new guidelines. Check it out. A very special thanks to today's guests, Dr. Paul Welton and Brian Williams. And also to my fellow deputy editor here at JAMA, Dr. Greg Kerfman. Also thanks to Lisa Harden, who scheduled everybody for the JAMA podcasts. Today's episode was produced by Michelle Krasinski. Our audio team here at JAMA includes Daniel Morrow, Jesse McQuarters, and Mike Berkowitz, the deputy editor for electronic media here at the JAMA Network. Once again, I'm Ed Livingston, deputy editor for Clinical Reviews and Education for JAMA. Thanks for listening.